Hey guys, it's your favorite sisters with the Confessions of a Reluctant Caregiver show on UK Health Radio. On the show, you'll hear caregivers confessing the good, the bad, and the completely unexpected. You're guaranteed to relate, be inspired, leave with helpful tips and resources, and of course, laugh. Now, let's jump right in to today's guest confession.
Hey, Jay.
Good morning, Natalie.
How are you doing?
If you're watching the YouTube video, you'll probably be able to see that I scratched my forehead twice. It looked like
I didn't know if you were going to mention that to everybody and all of our friends, because I was going to mention it because I was worried that people would not. We'd be talking about this forehead of yours and the assault that you did
on myself. It actually, get the YouTube video. Hopefully they won't post these photos.
Did you get closer to your camera so everybody can see it?
There you go. Well, and it's, you know, our guest said it's not that bad. My hair's on the mic. It's not that bad, but I impaled myself.
Being kind.
I impaled myself with my fingernail.
This is what happens when you grow your nails out, people.
I know, I was trying to be fancy, but it didn't work, so I'm going to trim them all.
Yeah. And I'm glad you part your hair that way, because away, so that way it's fully visible.
I'm done with it.
If you could just put an arrow in the
beep, beep,
video.
Beep,
beep, beep, beep, beep. It's like Beetlejuice.
That's
with
exactly
the arrows.
I'm done with
okay.
you.
But we're not here to talk about your forehead, which is considerable, or the scratch that you did.
I'm going to go be Trisha's best friend and ask her to be my sister, because I
have loves you.
She does. I'm going to tell you guys about today's guest, because she's pretty amazing. I just want to say that she could conceivably be my hero. And some of the things she says, they crack me up because she uses words that I use, and she's just very truthful. So today we've got with us Trisha Fitzgerald. Get ready, guys. She's an educator, an advocate, and a community leader with more than 20 years of experience supporting children and families. But she spent a lifetime as well, those same years, caring for her own family. So Trisha started her personal caregiving journey in 2003 when her first child was born. It took years of advocacy and persistence to get a diagnosis for that daughter. When her second daughter was born, Trisha added a caregiving journey in addition to traditional parenting for her. This daughter was diagnosed with an autoimmune inflammatory arthritis. Since that diagnosis in 2015.
Are you going to tell everybody all the details?
Hold on. Three more of her children received that same diagnosis. So this is what Trisha says. They tickle me. She says, my caregiving journey is certainly overwhelming, disheartening, and chaotic at times. And it certainly requires high levels of organization and tons of chutzpah. Here's my favorite. While we all experience some pretty awful days due to our conditions, I focus on modeling how it is okay to not be okay. But it's important to not get stuck in the yuckiness of forever. Yuckiness is one of my words, Trisha, and I am so happy to have you here with us today.
Yay!
I'm so happy to be here. You have no idea. I've been watching your podcast, and I absolutely love it. So thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for being here. Well, you know, I try to get JJ not to tell all the details so that you actually have a story. Otherwise, it's like, well, that was fast for a second. And we're done.
There's a lot to this one. Get ready.
Well, that's true. And JJ also didn't give the spoiler away. And
that's right.
Because it actually didn't start with kids. And that's the part that's really interesting. And so I think that lived experience, this is a unique episode, because we talk about traditional parenting versus what happens when you have children who have special needs. And special mm-hmm. needs is the broadest of broad categories. Mm-hmm. And so if you really think about it, it doesn't mean they have intellectual disabilities or any one particular thing, because most people think special needs and they think disabilities. And so I think this is what I love about the podcast, is just the diversity of people and their caregiving experiences, because somebody's going to hear this story and they're going to be like, ooh, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will stop flapping and let Trisha go ahead and start telling us her story.
Sure.
And so start from the beginning. You were born, and then kind of like, you know, tell us about your background.
I was born in the late 70s during a time. No, I'm just kidding. So I am from a suburb outside of Chicago, and I have an older brother and an older sister, amazing parents, God rest their souls. And, you know, I think, as you can probably understand, that was a time, well, even now today, it's difficult to have a chronic illness and get that diagnosed, especially for children. So yeah. I don't have confirmation of this because I wasn't diagnosed as a child, but I'm fairly certain that my journey with my chronic illness began when I was a child. So I began having symptoms when I was in the fourth grade, just a lot of tenderness and pain in my joints, in my hips and my knees and my ankles, you know, all of that. And I kept being told it was growing pains. I think that's the story of a lot of young people and adults who later get diagnosed. I had a lot of fatigue that beyond the, you know, I went to soccer practice and now I'm tired, like fatigue. Like I always felt like I had the flu. So I don't want to say I was blown off, but I definitely did not get listened to by medical professionals. Now my parents, I mean, of course my mom was nurturing and my dad was lovely and, you know, they didn't understand what I was going through, I don't think, on a lot of levels, mm-hmm. but they, it's not that they weren't listening. It's just, you know, it's the parameters of the medical system. Yeah. And so it was not until my late 30s that I was diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis that my children have. And actually it turns out that my husband has a similar, he has a genetic predisposition to all of this. So he also brought that to the table. So again, I think I have a juvenile form. I'm not 100% sure, but now that I have multiple children with it, it's pretty obvious to me that that's what's going on. Yeah. The combination of what I brought in and then my husband, but yeah. So as a young adult, so as a teenager, I was told I was just doing too much, you know, president of the club and playing soccer and all of that. Okay. So I tried to pare it down a little bit, you know, as much as we can when we're like the three of us, I did less. Yeah. And then get to college. Oh, you're just taking too many classes. You know, there was always a reason. Then I start having children. Oh, you're just a tired, busy new mom. So it was really, it was probably a journey a lot of people go through, right? Just feeling like you're saying all of the things, you're advocating for yourself, but you're not necessarily being heard. But the good news is I did get diagnosed finally, late 30s, ankylosing spondylitis, have now added a second diagnosis, which is not juvenile. Ooh. That's wishful thinking. No. So now I also have rheumatoid arthritis added to the mix. So it's like, join the party. Why not? Like, here we go. Let's have another autoimmune.
What's one more? Yeah. What's one more?
I mean, friends? I've always been an overachiever. So here we go. Might as well add another one.
Natalie and I are both going to say it. Wait till you hit menopause, dude. That's going to take forever for them to diagnose that.
Can you see me sweating over here? I'm pretty close.
They'll never diagnose that.
I'm telling you right now, this left shoulder is not the same. The sweats aren't here, but this left shoulder, the joint pain for those ladies that are listening, it's real and it's not frozen shoulder. The cortisone shot won't fix estrogen.
Exactly.
So, but anyway,
sorry, we digress.
Yeah. Well, that is not this kind of podcast, though.
But you're saying the thing, like, we get told these it's fibromyalgia, which is real. Don't get me wrong, but it's always these like dismissive diagnoses, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's frozen shoulder. It's this, it's that. So that was the start of my journey. So I was not a stranger to it once I started having children. That's for darn sure.
Yeah. So let me back up for a second. Sure. So you had these illnesses or you had these symptoms. Actually, it's the better words. You lived with symptoms and you probably lived with some level of pain and fatigue your entire life, but you move right along. You go to college. Mm-hmm. At what point do you meet your husband and when do kids start coming along and all that good jazz?
So finished college, was shortly out of college, trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. P.S. still trying to figure that out. So
everybody. So we can relate.
At least the most interesting people I know are still trying to figure it out. Well, until later in life. But I met my husband. It's actually kind of a fun story. So I was in between jobs. I started out with a nonprofit. I liked it, but I also hated it. So I was like, okay, something has to change. So, and I'm really proud of my younger self, by the way, that I figured that out and I made that move. I have to keep remembering who that person was when I'm in the middle of something that I'm like, why am I still doing this? So I leave this one job and I'm like, am I going to go to grad school? What am I going to do? I knew I needed to pay rent and eat. That's what I did know, right? Mm-hmm. So I heard on the radio station that they were looking for extras, like for filming in Chicago. And I thought, I'll try that out. Like, I don't want to be an actor, but I do want to eat and pay my rent, like I said. Mm-hmm. So I became an extra and I met some people through that and somehow got myself invited to a rap party, they're called. So it was like the end of a movie. It was a Steve Martin movie with, who else was in it? Laura Dern. It was called Novocaine. Anyhow, so my best friend is going and I'm going and I met her through the extra work and I answered the door for the people picking us up. And that was my now husband. So he was standing there. But the best part of the story is, one, I didn't want to go to this party. I thought I was the third wheel. And I was like, I don't want to go. But then I walk away from the door. I go up these winding stairs because she was house sitting, this beautiful house. And I said, they're here. And the guy driving is so cute. Or actually, he wasn't driving. He was the passenger, but whatever. I go, the guy who just was at the door is so cute. It echoes through the entire house.
Oh, nice.
So I'm like, I can't go back down there. But I did. I went down there. We met. And the rest is history. So we've been together since 2000. And at the time, the reason why my husband was there, he did lighting and special effects on movies. So the reason I bring that up is he's now a police sergeant. So he did a little.
I mean, that naturally fit right into it. Yeah, so maybe he's on the First 48. Maybe he's on, I think, of all of our crime shows. I mean, Chicago PD. Yeah. I mean, we throw out all the names here. Right. But, so he is a for real police officer.
He's a for real deal one. I mean, he's a creative, so it's just really interesting that shift that he made, right? But it definitely helps him out on the streets being a sergeant and being more of the creative mind. So, that's how we met. We've been together all that time and have 6 children together. So,
I love that. Mm-hmm. And you've got I love that I feel like you're all are Irish Catholic. Are you Irish Catholic? I feel like I am Irish Catholic.
Everyone asks us that with all the kids, but that probably didn't factor into it. But we lived in an Irish Catholic neighborhood for the very beginning of when we started having children. And it wasn't uncommon for someone to have 6 kids, definitely.
But no, of course not. My friend Susan, her dad was a fire chief in New York City, and there's 6 of them. They're all Irish Catholic. Yeah. I mean, just blonde, white hair. I mean, honestly, that's how I was like Chicago, Irish. I mean, it just naturally fits. Yeah. Again, caregiving podcast, but we're getting there, people. Calm down.
Well, and so I'm a teacher and he's a cop. Like, we couldn't be more cliche if we even tried. So
I did notice that. I think that's pretty magic. And you got a ton of kids. I mean, basically, and I'm going to tell you right now, we were talking to somebody else the other day, they only had 5 kids. I'm like, dude, you needed one more for the 6th coming off the bench. You just needed one more for basketball. I mean, like, you got to have the 6 players. Exactly. I mean, I'm just saying.
Extra spare.
Number 6. Yeah. So anyway, so you all are moving along. Yeah. You are having, and you get in, and you get pregnant and you have a baby. And so then what happens? Because care starts coming in pretty early after you have your first nugget.
It does. You know, immediately I thought, what happens? I remember this distinct moment when the nurses all walked out, because, I mean, we could talk for hours, ladies, like the story of my first daughter's birth. Like, we barely got there in time, but my labor was days long. So that was a whole thing. There was 9 nurses in the room. It was amazing and chaotic. It was basically a metaphor for our entire life and family life together. It was of course, that's how it went. But my husband and I look at each other, and it's quiet for the first time in forever. And I said, what do we do now? And he was like, oh.
I felt that way when I brought home a puppy.
Like we're in charge.
And a lot of responsibility, apparently.
That's what I hear. No. So so from the, literally the moment she was born, that we knew something was amiss. Like, she was amazing, but she rolled over on her first day of life. And no one ever believes me. I'm not kidding you. She was so hypertonic. She rolled over in her isolate. The doctors were like, did that just happen? Yeah. So that should have been everyone's first clue something was going on. So there was just a lot in with our first child that, again, was amazing, but were red flags. And I have my master's in early childhood development. So it's that balance of, if you read too many books and you know too much, you can get in your own way. So I was trying not to be that mom. Like, every burp she does, is there a problem? But there was clearly something happening. And so it was a journey of going to our PCP saying, I know I'm hearing you say that she's just maybe a higher need baby, but they just had to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. So it took us 4.5 years to get a diagnosis for that one. Mm. And along the whole way, wondering if I was crazy. Still wonder on a daily basis.
Well, yeah, crazy. I mean, that's relatively speaking, but at the beginning, but here's the funny thing though, is that if you think about mamas with who have their first children. I mean, because JJ turned out really great. And I think my mom was just tired after trying to deal with Jay. And then by the time we got to Emily, I mean, I'm glad she's alive. And so, but I mean, you put so much focus in. And so I like the fact that you said, hey, look, my background is in childhood development and our child development. And so I'm looking at it and reading all the books and trying to be a great mom and so it makes sense that you'd be like, am I overthinking this?
Right.
And you almost wonder, would it have been the same? And the answer is probably yes, because you'd have been like, this is not the same as the first.
Well, it was when my second came along. So that was an interesting time. I was 5 months postpartum. I had just maybe started sleeping, found out I was pregnant with my second. And that was a moment. I had a lot of moments. I was like, but was obviously so thankful, you know, when she came along. But she was a typically developing baby, whatever that means.
Yeah.
But I thought she was broken. I literally thought she was broken because she was sleeping and she was eating. She was doing all of the things that a baby should be doing. So now I felt even more crazy because I'm like, why am I staring at her while she sleeps? So making sure she's breathing. And I took her to the doctor and I'm like, there's something wrong with her. She's broken. They're like, what do you mean? She's going right along with everything. I said, well, because this is my first and then this one. And that's when I think it really started to shine a light. It still took until my daughter was 4.5 So it still took a little bit of time, but that's when, you know, you're not supposed to compare your kids, but when you have one who's typically developing and you have one who has things going on, you know, it really, it shone a light on there. And then my second daughter did not get that diagnosis until the juvenile arthritis until she was in fourth grade, I believe. But we started to see things like with her motor development, all of that, that led us down that path. But as a baby, it was just those differences. Right. And so it really helped me go, you know what? My instincts were right with the first one.
Listening to the mama instinct.
Listen to
I'm gonna
that.
Wait. I need to pause this. I need to pause this just for a second because I'm not surprised. We're already time for our first break. More kids coming, people. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
All right, everybody, we are back here with Trisha Fitzgerald. We got two kids so far. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about kids with a special diagnosis. So I'm going to back up here, not really back up, but I'm going to pause and I'm going to talk about where your all's lives are. So you got two kids.
Oh, good question.
And yeah. So tell me where you are. Or first of all, is your husband, you know, is he a police officer yet? You're teaching. Like, what are you guys doing? Cause I know you're doing like advocacy. You're like, what is our diagnosis? How are you feeling? Because you've in life gotten different diagnoses. How are y'all feeling? What are you doing?
So I was a teacher when I had my first. I was teaching in the Chicago Public Schools and my husband was still doing the film and TV work. It just became almost like a full-time job trying to figure out what was going on with my firstborn and then finding out I was pregnant again. So I ended up coming out of the classroom, no longer was doing that, but still wanted to do something outside of the home, but also be completely present. So I ended up starting my own business. I became a doula and a childbirth educator and an early childhood consultant. So I created a business and I think that I supported close to 300 families in that journey from the time I started it right after, I think I was pregnant with my third actually, all the way until I think right before I had my last child. Yeah, I don't know. It's all fuzzy. But in that time I did that. And I also was working part-time at night at the university where I had gone and gotten my master's. So I was teaching teachers how to teach, basically, is the easiest way to put it, and supervising student teachers. So that's where I was. My husband actually had just transitioned into becoming a police officer. So a lot of transition. And then we moved to a new house. That was the Irish Catholic neighborhood I was talking about. So just a lot of exciting things happening, but a lot on top of it all. So now I have two girls and then find out I'm pregnant with my, well, actually I ended up losing and having a miscarriage, which I come to find out is part of my autoimmune. I'm at a much higher risk, but a lot of women have them, right? Like I'm not dismissing it or minimizing, but like, it was just something that I was like, okay, well, it was always a risk, right? So I had a loss and then thankfully got pregnant again and had my third daughter. So now we have three girls and everything was awesome.
We also believe three girls are awesome as well.
Yeah, that's why I highlighted it. We had three girls. Things were great. But then started to see more and more symptoms, you know, in the second born. Didn't see anything in the third born yet, but that's where we were. Yeah, it was exciting time. Wow. I was exhausted all the time, but it was exciting.
I would say you were because you're dealing with your own chronic illness. You're dealing with a baby, the oldest, has a diagnosis at this point. You've got the middle that's demonstrating, I'm assuming. What are the age differences between all the kids?
15 months between the first two and then 22 months between the second and third. And I had, like I said, that early loss in there. So I was basically pregnant the entire time. Like I had a short reprieve in there.
You just keep having kids every 2 years or so. I like the stair step. We're all stair stepped. Like we're all 2 years apart.
Right.
And the OBGYN was like,
what is that?
I said the OBGYN was like, hey, Trisha.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for keeping us in business and sending my kids to college.
We were on a first name basis. People would look at me like I had six heads. The nurses would be like, you called her that? Yeah. You know, we're besties.
You know, here's my question. A lot of people would say you've got kids that have these illnesses, right? These are chronic illnesses. And at some point, because you ultimately and your husband have six children. The question is at some point, do you all say, should we not have kids? Should we not have kids because we seem to keep having children that have these illnesses? I don't know the answer to that. That's why I'm asking, because I think a lot of people could ask that question.
Oh, absolutely. So I don't know if it's thankfully or not. We didn't really find out that it was autoimmunes until my second born was in fourth grade. And we were just having baby after baby after baby. So by that point, and I don't even know what year that was. I think we probably already had all six, or maybe five of six.
Oh, the horses were out of the barn at that point.
Right, exactly. And I feel like it's thankfully, because if I'm being real, and I'm sure I can be here, I don't know that I would have kept having kids. Yeah. Like, they are my biggest joy. They're what I live for. I wouldn't change anything. But I don't know. It might have made me pause. But at the same time, we have learned to live with what we have going on. And it's not, you know, we try to focus on the positive parts of it. So yeah. I don't know, but maybe not. Maybe I would have pumped the brakes a little bit. And yeah.
So you've got the kids are all really kind of stair-stepped, if you think about it. You have kids at some point that are continuing to get some level, they're all experiencing some level of symptom that's impacting them. And so you and your husband are setting back, and because you've got a lot going on. Six kids is a lot anyway, period. I mean, three is a lot. And so, you know, honestly, I'm sure after three, you're just like, what's one more? What's one more? And so How is, because you've got the pressure of having six kids on your relationship, but then you also have the pressure of all the doctor's appointments, all the things that they have to do. And don't forget the IEPs that might, or 504 plans that need to be done. Because I don't know which one, if you had either, just because they might need accommodations because of their illnesses. And so what strain does that put on you and your husband and you personally?
That's such an important question. Puts a lot of strain, a lot of strain. I mean, it's already so exhausting just to be a parent, right?
Yeah.
Finding time for yourself, finding time together, right? And navigating through, I'm not going to call it a dark time, but it was a very trying time, you know, during the times that my children were small. And it was beyond the normal, right? Because how do you coordinate your schedules? You're trying to work full time. I'm trying to keep this business going and bring in some money and also feel fulfilled. Like, things fall to the wayside, right? Spending time together alone. It was beyond like, oh, can we afford a babysitter? Like, we just physically couldn't do it for many years there. Yeah. We just couldn't do anything beyond be in survival mode. So that was tricky. It really was, but it does get better. It does, but it's an everyday journey, right? Like, it's every day taking a deep breath and going, okay, like, yes, chronic pain causes certain moods. It turns out my husband also has symptoms. So, but being a man and being in his field and all of these things, right? Learning to stuff it down. So it's like navigating all of this together. But I feel like in a lot of ways it made us stronger and brought us together. Mm-hmm. Like, this sort of thing can either tear a family apart or it can bring you together. And we chose to let it bring us together. But I'm not trying to paint a picture like it was fine and dandy and, you know, all just an easy cakewalk. It really was a lot of years there of, you know, are we going to make it? Are we not? But he is my best friend. You know, I can't imagine going through this without him. So, yeah.
So no unicorns and rainbows there. So diagnosis wise, just out of curiosity, how did it come? So I know you said fourth grade was really kind of your second daughter. How did those come, the years? How did those progress?
I was thinking about this last night. I don't really remember. Like, you get this sort of, this is why the human species still exists, right? Like, we forget.
That's exactly right.
After we give birth. It's the same sort of thing when you go through this. So I don't remember exactly when it all unfolded, but it was like diagnosis after diagnosis. And I think I always told Sydney, my daughter, who's 20, my second born, she crawled so the rest of the kids could walk and run. But the funny part about it, she never crawled. That's how we knew something was up with her. She scooted. But everything she was going through, and then coupling my experiences growing up with hers, I started to be really good at of seeing things with my kids. And so when my firstborn son, Mickey, said, oh, I'm feeling this and this, I'm like, let's go to the doctor. Like, you know, you just know right away. Or when my daughter Macy, who's now 18 and going off to college, same sort of thing. Like, it wasn't the exact same symptoms, but it was just enough that I was like, eh. But then I also had to take a deep breath and go, not just because it's, you know, you have a hammer, not everything's a nail. So I had to, like,
that's right,
step back a little bit. So that's tricky too when you're dealing with the school system, because they're like, oh, here comes that mom. She thinks all over something.
Do you feel like you got, not to say better, but do you feel like the diagnosis is the doctors were willing to say, yes, this is what it is earlier? Like, this lady is experienced, or you still were fighting for them?
You know, there are so few rheumatologists for children in the United States. Mm-hmm. So while that's a terrible thing, it also means that they all talk to each other. So I feel like once we had the diagnosis, not for my first daughter, my second born, it was like the second one. Once that one came into play, they were like, okay, she might be crazy, but not for this reason. So listen to this mom. And then I advocated as much as I could and modeled advocating. And so then it was like my kids were taking over for themselves. They were not gonna, be dismissed. So good luck to any doctor who encounters them.
Is there differences in the diagnosis of the girls versus the boys?
Absolutely. And we were just talking about this yesterday. So I'm moving my daughter into college and my 20-year-old's with me. And somehow we got onto this topic. And it was funny because in my memory, my 20-year-old had MRIs done of her back and all of these things. She's like, Mom, no, I still to this day have not been able to get an MRI of my back. And I was like, are you kidding? So here I am, like literally at a gas station, like truck stop. And I'm sitting outside the Dunkin', you know, and I'm like looking. I said, do I have permission to get into your MRI chair? She said, yeah. So I go in and she's right. She has not had an MRI of her back. This young lady is 20 and has had a diagnosis since 10 years, has never had one. And she goes, you know, I'm still so upset that. And so my firstborn son, Mickey, he got an MRI immediately, like immediately the doctors ordered one, like immediately. And she goes, you know, I'm real happy for him. I was like, oh, I didn't tell. She's like, I'm really happy for him. You know, it helped him get the diagnosis he needed. So yes, my sons, and you know, you could argue, well, you had other kids already with the diagnosis, so they knew what path to go down. But no, like totally different rheumatologist than the one they had, but still same hospital system right away had an MRI. And then my second son out of the whole group that has it, same thing. So we have seen glaring differences. When you have an autoimmune, they tend to start you on like an anti-inflammatory first. And then if that doesn't work, it's like that step therapy, right? Which I advocate against. I'm like, no, we know what this is. Like, let's go for it. But the period of time they made my girls be on that and suffering, like truly suffering versus my boys. Now, thankful that my boys got the treatment they needed quickly. But man, it was so glaring. Yeah.
That's okay. I'm going to take the pause right here and we're going to pick right back up and we'll be right back. But that's, I had a feeling you're going to tell me that. So we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, everybody, we are back here with Tricia Fitzgerald. So kids are 22 and 11. Is that our range right now?
Yep. She'll be 20. They'll both be, she'll be 22 in October and he'll be 12 in October. So they're 11 years apart to the day. Yep.
To the day. I love that. Yeah. I love that.
Hold on. Go ahead. Can I math? He's 10. He'll be 11. I'm sorry. See, when you have this many kids, I'm like,
that doesn't matter.
You'll be 11. You're good.
He'll be 11, good. 11, and she'll be 22. Yeah. I can go.
So everybody can, you know, they can find their own food. They can forage. So we're good with that, you know. How's life now? Like, how has it transitioned as everyone's gotten a little older? And some of them are out on their own.
They are.
Hey, everybody's out of diapers. I'm just excited for you on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Part.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's so much better. But, you know, as any parent knows, it doesn't get necessarily easier. It just changes. Mm-mm. Right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So my older girls, I think it's just awesome to watch them, like I said, getting their own voice, advocating for themselves. But then that's the tricky. You're going out on your own now. And am I supposed to be with a pediatric doctor? Do I need to switch to an adult doctor? So that's difficult when you have really formed that relationship. And so they're navigating that on their own with me kind of there, you know, as backup. So
how do you feel about that? Are you letting go or?
Absolutely. Yeah. I always wondered how I would feel, but
out of the nest.
It's tricky, right? Because like, I can see sometimes that they're not necessarily probably getting what I would think is the best care, but I do have to shut my mouth because it's their journey. Right.
Right.
But you know, especially with things like insurance and approvals, you know, all of that sort of thing, like that is tricky stuff. And so they do come to me still with all of that, but you know, dropping my daughter at college, you know, she's 2.5 hours from the nearest rheumatologist and like, how is she going to navigate those appointments? And so that's a different kind of stress, right? It's that worry. But do you ever stop worrying about your kids, whether they have a diagnosis or not? So, yeah.
We are always transparent. And so we met Tricia through CVS, who we work with. She's a specialty pharmacy user. So are we with our mom. And so, you know, I'll say, and that's why I want to be transparent about it. But you had, and we watched your video that where you really utilize specialty pharmacy and how they support you. And it really comes back down to you were managing 50 meds at one point. And that to me was like, she is a total bad A. Like, she is like nailing it.
So holy smoke.
Every caregiver is going to be like, how did you do it, Tricia? What's your secret? Trying to make sure that you're supporting and keeping everybody alive at the same time.
I probably shouldn't say drink heavily, right? No, I'm kidding.
Okay. I mean, it is an intervention. Okay. It's fine. Just, you know, your husband was sober.
Right. No. In all seriousness. So it was years of trying to figure out a system, years and years.
Okay.
But really, honestly, like you brought up CVS, their phone calls, while can be annoying, those really were helpful. Right. Especially if I already refilled it. I'm like, I already refilled it, but thank goodness, because there have been text messages. I get text alerts, phone calls, and emails reminding me. So that's been super helpful. I had at one point, like a you know, just an old school calendar that I was writing everything on, just reminders of who takes what, when. And then I think having so many kids on meds, I learned that if we can try to streamline it. So if they're taking something every 2 weeks, try to get it where all the kids are taking it on the same day. Now I have teens and young adults now. So when they're all home for break and whatever, like, do they take it on the day they're supposed to? No, they have injections. Like, it's me going, okay, it's on the calendar for Wednesday. It's now Thursday. It's now Friday, you know, but trying to get them to take that over has been really, you know, it's a journey of its own.
In the beginning, you know, I hear you say, okay, there was a calendar and we took it on the same day. Now it's kind of like off. So I'm thinking, you know, it's like, okay, it's a day late. It's kind of like me and my dog in the flea medicine. I'm like, oh, look, it's a week late and it's okay. So in the beginning, I'm thinking you were probably like, it has to be, you know, Thursday at 12 o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
So now do you give yourself a little grace? Like, do you be, you know, are you like, okay, you know, I did it, but the world is not ending. Like, how does your feeling? Are you lesser of a caregiver because you missed it? Or are you like, dude, it's going to be okay. Everybody's going to live.
Depends on how much sleep I got and my mood. No, but,
I got you.
I
feel that.
Yeah. I think of it as, not that it's not a life-saving med, because in so many ways we got our lives back. I always tell people, when I got on this one certain injection, once I got my diagnosis, I felt like I had my life back. So in that sense, it is life-saving, right? But I always just try to remember they're going to be okay if it's a day or two late. Now, these types of meds. Now, I know there are some meds you have to take, like, very regimented. And thankfully, you know, we are blessed that that's not the case. So I've learned on my journey to give myself grace, teach the children to give themselves grace, but also be mindful. You still need to take this med. Like, this is a non-negotiable. And that's really tricky, because it's heartbreaking when your child first starts an injection and they're terrified, right? I guess this is the good side of having a lot of kids that have it, though. You know, having your teen daughter be the first one to give your son an injection. So he's going to trust her, weirdly, because they're like fighting like cats and dogs. She's going to trust her a little bit more, I think, because she's, you know, young and going through it. So I don't know. It's been quite the journey of, well, the biggest part for me is remembering I also take meds. So as a caregiver,
take care of yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. You have to take care of yourself.
Sure. Right. Seems so elementary, but I just noticed this morning I have one pill left of two of my meds. Like, how did that happen? I don't know. So I make sure everyone else has their meds, as we do as caregivers. And sometimes I forget about myself, whether it's medication or just self-care or what have you. So yeah, I have to remember that we all matter. We all need to be mindful of that. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that as everybody, you're kind of leaving the nest? How is your marriage now? How is relationship going?
New phase, obviously, with the empty nest things starting to happen. But I think that, you know, not that my husband ever didn't get it, but I was doing the caretaking and he really, that wasn't his primary role. And now I'm back working full time, you know, for almost 10 years now. And so he had no choice. He had no choice but to become a big part of it. So he really, and I think that helped me tremendously, you know, seeing, he was always invested, but it was in a different way. So that just kind of took us to a new phase where he's like, no, I got it. And he'll take them to the rheumatology appointments. We're still working on making sure he schedules the next appointment before he leaves the office. Cause that's part of what my system is too. Like, I know myself, I am not going to remember. I got to schedule it, get it on my calendar, you know, then go to my chart, then put the include detail. Like, I have this whole thing and I have to also remember he's his own person. He does it differently, you know? So it's that balance of.
That's a true caregiver right there. Because I remember when we went to do respite for Emily, who had been caring for mom, she was given these very explicit details. And I stopped listening at turn right. Cause I was like, eh, she'll be fine. And I'm like, turn right at the cow. It's fine. We're from rural East Tennessee. It's funny because I think that's as caregivers, that's the hardest thing to give up because number one, you're the caregiver, but you will always be primary role, the mama bear.
Right.
And the mama bear likes things done the certain way. And I remember when Emily had her children, she was very explicit with her husband about what he could and could not do. And so I think that would be kind of hard. But what was the point where you did you have to have a conversation and say, I need you to come in more? I need you to get closer into caring and helping me with this, as opposed to being a little bit more traditional male, like the wife's got it. I mean, we just call it for what it is. Women are seen as the caregivers, typically. We just call it for what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just one conversation. It was a lot of them. But being that he's not just a man, he's in such a male-dominated, you know, like he's a police officer, right?
Yeah, he really is.
So
he's manly man.
Yeah, exactly. And so he was never resistant to it. I just think he didn't know how, right? Mm-hmm. He just didn't know. And I can't fault someone for not having that skill set. You know, I had to get past my assumptions that he didn't want to. Like I was... The best thing I ever learned, and I think it was a therapist who told me, she said, unspoken needs and wants are premeditated resentments. And I was like, whoa,
ooh, whoa,
whoa. Ooh. And so I, you know, and I already communicate so much, like to the point my husband's probably like, is she still talking? But I wasn't necessarily saying the things that I really needed to be saying. Right. And so I had to learn, like, he's not a mind reader, you know, and then I had to express that to him. Like, I'm not a mind reader. Like I don't know how you're feeling in all of this. And so it's been years of us learning how to communicate in a really healthy way. And so we're not, you know, we're not 100% there yet, but that changed everything for me when I heard that.
Well, yeah. You know, I'm not going to lie to you. That is clearly going to be a clip because that's good advice.
That's powerful.
Really good, sound advice. And sometimes, and you've mentioned going to a counselor. I mean, sometimes that's what you need. Independent person to be able to hear what you're saying, give a different perspective and say, have you thought about it this way? And I can tell you how many times I've gotten frustrated with my husband, even now, you know, I don't want to be your mom. I don't want to tell you what to have to do. Yes. And, but I'm glad you mentioned that because I guess if I don't tell him certain things, then I end up having to get into this and you get in and it's so circular.
It is.
You get into these and it becomes it's unnecessary. And I think, so stop us, you know, for me, I would say to myself, stop assuming Jason knows everything that you want in your mind.
Right. Right. Exactly. Like they may be your person, but they don't necessarily, you know, weirdly, they can't read your thoughts. Well, and I'm all over the place. Right. I thought it was just part of the whole deal, but there's some days where I'm feeling this and then there's other days. And I'm sure it's very confusing for him because he's like, well, but as long as I'm communicating it, right? And I keep telling him that as well. But there's that piece of like, I think, and maybe it's sexist to say this, but men are not taught to be vulnerable. They're not taught that it's safe.
Yeah.
So it's been a lot of those conversations of it's okay to talk about your feelings, but then remembering maybe he doesn't have the words for the feelings. So, right? Like, I don't know. I just feel off or I just feel whatever. So, I mean, we just had this conversation right before I left with my daughter. Like I could see, you know, the body tension and the way he was holding his body. Yeah. And I was like, do you feel it? Do you see it? And he was like, I'm just, you know, and he got defensive at first. And then the thing, so my parents had this thing when they would start to get at each other, they would yell mashed potatoes. That was the thing that stopped them. I know. So it was hilarious.
Fantastic.
One of them would just go mashed potatoes. So the thing my husband and I do, and then they would both laugh, right? Like, how can you not? Someone's screaming mashed potatoes at you. So my husband and I, have you seen that meme where the guy goes, oh, what is that? Is that a mockingbird? And then it goes to the clip of the mockingbird. And the mockingbird's going, oh, is that a mockingbird? Is that a mockingbird? Yeah. It's so goofy. But anytime he's starting to get defensive now, he'll catch himself and take a breath and go, oh, is that a mockingbird? And then I just start cracking up. And I do it to myself as well. So I got him to kind of slow down, do the mockingbird. And then, which sounds hilarious. And then he went, you know, I think I'm stressed about, I don't know. And I go, well, what could possibly be going on this week? Oh yeah. You're leaving with our daughter to take her to college. And then we have two of our boys away at camp this week for arthritis camp. So just kind of teaching each other, it's okay again, to not be okay and to pause, to breathe. Do your mockingbird or mashed potatoes or whatever it is you do, you know, to bring levity to the situation and then talk about it. I mean, it's not perfect. Like there's doors slammed and whatever, but once in a while, but this is kind of where we've evolved to, which when I think back to years, you know, 10 years ago, I never would have dreamed this is where we'd be. Yeah. And it's awesome.
Yeah, those are basic marriage skills though, Trisha. You know, I mean, that's advice for anybody. That's so fantastic to just say you have to de-escalate it and go add mashed potatoes or mockingbird. Yeah. Those are just fantastic. You know, that is fantastic.
Well, and we do the same thing with the kids when they're having a hard time, right? You got to bring levity, de-escalate. Does it always work? No. But we try.
Yeah. But you know what? I will say this, if you really think about it, it comes back to being a safe word and really just saying, I'm not okay. I'm upside down, or I need to pause. And a lot of people think that they can't walk away from a difficult conversation and come back to it. Mm-hmm. And so I think many caregivers, and I'm sure Mom and Emily experience this together, but this is any, whether it's parent-child dynamic, whether it's a caregiver dynamic with the person they're caring for, or just could be siblings, it's anybody. How do you start teaching healthy ways to have difficult conversations? And when you get to a point, you need to step away and that you can come back so that you can finish the conversation. Because the last thing you really want to have to do is have a relationship repair, because that means you let it go too far. But if you let it go too far, you need to repair the relationship, because otherwise that's inside of you like a cancer and it just eats at you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's pretty big. You know, it's time. I can't believe this, because we are well over our time. I think it's time to ask our other sister some questions.
I know. I have two, but the first one is a little more in depth, but the second one is not. Okay. How does it make you feel as a mom to see the kids' relationship together and how they help one another? How does it make you feel?
How does it make me feel? There's so many different feelings. One of them is, okay, let's start with the positive. I feel really proud of the journey that we've been on, my husband and me and my kids, those good days and those bad days, right? And working together. But then there's that mama guilt too. Back to one of your first questions of, you know, or when you mentioned they might want their money back, you know, it's like, so it's awesome to see them helping each other and advocating, and because they innately know, you know, they don't know exactly what someone's feeling, but they know what it's like to have a chronic illness and have a bad day. So that's awesome. It makes me feel so good. But then there are moments of that mama guilt of like, oh, sucks that they have to go through this. Right. But that's where I am. I mean, I do my best to not internalize that and make that my own, because it's where we are. It's what we're dealing with. Right. It's the cards we were dealt. So yeah, it's pretty awesome seeing them work together.
Yeah. I like focusing on acknowledging the hard, but not focusing on the positive, because all it's done is built resilience. They're going to be pretty darn resilient kids.
100%. There are days though, where I can see it on their face. They're like, but I don't want to have to be so resilient. Right. And that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's that serenity prayer. I always say we have to accept the things that we can't change and know the difference between the things we can and can't. And so it's really awesome to see them working together and supporting each other. And of course there's like the normal sibling things too, where I'm like,
hair.
It doesn't matter how many chronic illnesses these kiddos have. They're kids.
No, they're kids. No, you're good. The one thing, here's my fast. The one thing that when you're, you know, we talk about the yuckiness, you got to get out of the yuckiness. What's your thing? What's your thing that you would say to somebody?
Well, so our thing is finding the glimmers, right? And finding those positive moments, even if the rest of the day was just, you know. So we try to do things together, you know, like it's something simple, like just cuddling on the couch, right? I love that my 12, soon to be 13-year-old still cuddles. Actually, he just turned 12. Why am I trying to make him older? I don't know. Or is he 13? Y'all, I don't know how old my kids are. But my son is going into 8th grade. I think he's 13. He just still crawls up into the bed and like wants to cuddle. He still wants to watch Netflix. So I'm holding on to those moments, right? So on those good days and bad days, but also music, live music is our thing. So like we just went to see Melissa Etheridge and Indigo Girls just 2 nights ago together.
Oh, they're going to be better kids because of that. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. So we even take road trips. Like we'll get in the car and we'll drive to another state to go to live music together, or just down the street to a place. To me, music is pain relief. Like it really is, it's what keeps me going. And so I've kind of tried to pass that down to my kids. So yeah, that's what we do. We try to find those glimmers and not get stuck. Like acknowledge we're having a bad day or a bad week or a month or whatever, but not get stuck in that. Yeah.
Okay. I have one last question and then we're going to be besties forever, because this makes me so happy. Okay. So this is always my favorite question. What is your favorite guilty pleasure? What is the thing that you do just for you that you love to do just for you?
You're not sharing with anybody.
Oh my gosh. My ice cream. That's number one. I have to pick one.
you can have multiple.
You can have multiple. We
what is your favorite guilty pleasure?
Honestly, I probably my ice cream, mint chocolate chip ice cream. I mean, so much so, like, I have to stick with this one because even at my work, someone bought a tub of it for me. How do they even know that I like my tub? Like, I must be obsessed with it. If even my staff is buying me. I was like, you know, I love your staff. So that must be my thing. My ice cream, definitely do not eat out of my ice cream bowl because I might snap on you. But I would have said like going to music shows, but now that's what we do together, right? So
yeah,
that's my guilty pleasure. Yeah. I mean, spending way more money than I ever should on going to shows and then eating ice cream afterwards.
I thank you so much for being with us and really appreciate it. Appreciate all the sharing of the knowledge and all that greatness.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Jay, you want to close this out?
Absolutely. Natalie, until we confess again, we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Well, friends, that's a wrap on this week's confession. Thank you so much for listening in on UK Health Radio. But before you go, please take a moment to leave us a review and tell your friends about the Confession Show. Don't forget, visit our website to sign up for our newsletter and connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Twitter. You'll also find the video recording of all our episodes on the Confessions website and our YouTube channel. We'll see you next Tuesday when we come together to confess again. Till then, take care of you.